Well, good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, and this is the Offbeat Oregon History Podcast, which every weekday brings you another story from the archives of the Offbeat Oregon History syndicated newspaper column. A new column gets added to the archives every Friday, you know, and today's Friday, so this story is brand new. Well, sort of. You know, the newspapers get these columns exclusively for 2 months, so I can't post them on offbeatoregon.com until those 2 months have gone by. Well, for this story, they've just gone by. So it just went live on the website today, and I'm going to read it to you now. Thank you very much for loading me down and queuing me up, and I hope you enjoy this show. For the story I've got for you today, I get to go back to my favorite time in Portland history, my favorite time for me to have not lived. That would be the 1890s. Actually, we're starting in the 1890s and moving forward until about the 1920s in this case. We're talking about union squabbles. They were a real big part of life on the Portland waterfront back then. Every few years in the early 1900s, burly and hard-fisted dock workers would get into a battle of wills with the autocratic sea captains that ran the shipping companies, and most of the time the dock workers got the worst of it. That would change, but not until the 30s. This story was first published on March 31st, 2013. Like I said, it's brand new on the wires today, and I'm going to read it to you now. Here we go. The first couple decades of the 20th century were rocky ones for everyone involved with the shipping industry in Portland. The law had just changed in 1915, prohibiting shipboard officers from physically beating sailors. Before that, they were allowed to do that. The waterfront was still peppered with watering holes in which strangers were being shanghaied, and the longshoremen, the burly men who did the hard, dangerous physical labor of loading cargo on ships, the longshoremen were starting to get serious about joining a union, or forming one. Well, unions weren't a new thing on the waterfront. Down in San Francisco during the gold rush, the longshoremen struck for and got a $6 a day wage deal, which was a phenomenal amount of money in the 1840s. Of course, you have to remember they were competing with the possibility of going inland and striking it rich, so they had to pay them pretty princely sums. On the docks in Portland, the first union formed in the 1860s, the late 60s. What was new in the 1900s, though, was the growing antagonism between longshoremen and the hard, autocratic men they worked for. Men who, in most cases, had grown up in the maritime environment of the 1880s and 1890s, when sailors were routinely disciplined with lash and fist and the captain's word had the force of iron law. Their transition to a more democratic social philosophy would not be a smooth one. Quote,
"My experience has shown me that quietness has been secured in a few days when union men went to the hospital in ambulances," remarked one such autocrat. That would be Captain Robert Dollar of the Dollar Steamship Line, when a San Francisco newspaper reporter asked about labor unrest. Captain Dollar and his fellow maritime entrepreneurs had banded together late in the 1800s to form a sort of anti-union, the Shipowners Protective Union, which worked hard to keep, quote, open shops, basically employment at will with no requirement of union membership for workers, and to keep labor costs as low as possible. In this, they were successful, predictably given that they were well-financed and well-organized and their opponents were not. But as so often happens in long conflicts like this, once they started winning these fights, they didn't know when to stop. In the 1890s, the SPU felt powerful enough to impose actual wage cuts on dock workers, which saved a little money for the employers but set the stage for some very expensive activity down the road. The employers were in the process of learning, the hard way, that when people who work for you don't feel fairly treated, you lose money. It would take decades for this lesson to sink in, though. The employers weathered a big strike in 1901 down in California that left all West Coast longshoremen's unions considerably weakened, whether they'd participated in it or not. And for a time, the employers felt pretty confident. By 1914, though, union activity on the waterfront was back up to levels that the employers thought were threatening. So they tried a new tactic. They formed a new employers' union and negotiated a deal with the longshoremen's union. Basically, they bamboozled the naive labor negotiators into signing a contract that explicitly cut them off from the support of other unions representing Teamsters and seamen and such. Brilliant move. Did not take long for the union to figure out they'd been had. 2 years later, the union unilaterally abrogated the deal,
violating the termination clause by giving 2 weeks' notice instead of 2 months, which was another big mistake, and went out on another strike. This time, they were demanding a closed shop, one in which the employers agree to hire only union workers. The strike was a repeat of 19-1, except that 1,000 workers in Portland actually participated in this one. In response, the Portland Chamber of Commerce started a petition drive to put a referendum on the ballot that would outlaw closed shops. This went nowhere. But it also was different in that the employers were able to prevent other unions from helping the longshoremen out. Most likely, the Teamsters and seamen were miffed at the longshoremen's willingness to sign that 1914 contract. In any case, on their own, the longshoremen were only able to last a few months before they were forced to make the best deal they could, basically pre-strike conditions, and sheepishly slink back to work. Resentment continued to simmer on the waterfronts of the West Coast until 1919, just after World War I, when San Francisco went on another strike, this time giving proper notice under its contract. Captain Robert Dollar, never one to sit on his hands at such a moment, organized a, quote, vigilance committee for purposes of co-opting the legal system as a strike-breaking tool. Dollar and his associates would file charges against union people and then burst into the courtroom in force during the trial to encourage a guilty verdict. In one case, Dollar later boasted that the capitalist vigilantes actually threatened to lynch a judge, a sitting judge, on the bench, whom they saw as insufficiently sympathetic to their side. Once again, the other unions stayed out of the fight. Once again, the strikers were simply worn down. They didn't have enough cash to continue. This time, the employers turned the strike into a lockout and entered negotiations with a strong hand. All of which leads up to 1922, when the Portland unions were essentially broken. 1922 is when Portland unions went on strike, when its union's contract actually ran out, and the employers announced they were going to handle hiring from now on. That, of course, meant union membership would now make it harder to get a job rather than easier. So, Portland longshoremen walked out, and the employers were ready for them. In a crucial innovation, they brought an old steamship, the F.J. Potter, and moored it at the dock so that strikebreakers could live on board. This would stop them having to cross picket lines at work. Strikebreakers, of course, are employees hired to replace striking workers, what the union people would call scabs. As a result of this, the strike barely slowed the port down. A week later, the employers announced they'd reopen the port, and they pretty much had. Frustration mounted among the union guys and found its way out in fistfights and other outbreaks of violence, which the employers used as a pretext to seek and get a court injunction preventing union members from congregating in places where there, quote, might be outbreaks of violence, which of course is a pretty versatile piece of language. Union members and pickets started getting arrested. Now, at last, the other unions started getting involved. Cargo loaded by strikebreakers was labeled hot, meaning that other union members wouldn't handle it, and U.S. government officials made several attempts to mediate the strike. But the employers, clearly sensing that they had the upper hand, would have none of it. They were going for the win this time. Finally, on June 22nd, they clinched it. The employers essentially dictated the terms of the agreement that ended the strike, and they arranged it smoothly so that the union would be essentially destroyed without the appearance of them having done anything. A joint hiring hall was established with both union and employer representatives, which sounded fair, but the hall would be used to hire both union and non-union dock workers, which was a guaranteed source of future friction and conflict. That conflict would serve, within a month or two, as a pretext for the employers to lock the union out of the hall. And that was the end of the Longshoremen's Union in Portland, until 12 years later in 1934, when it would rise again in the West Coast-wide labor eruption that became known as Bloody Thursday. We'll talk about that another time. Next week, actually, to be exact. Well, that's our show for today. This show is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. In addition to this podcast, it includes a weekly newspaper column, a daily RSS feed to catch on your smartphone reader, a Facebook page, a Twitter feed, and a couple other minor components, all accessible through our anchor page at offbeatoregon.com. Photographs and other images that go with today's show are also on offbeatoregon.com, along with full citations to the sources for this story. And while you're there, you can browse through more than 200 other articles written over the last 5 years, all organized by the date of publication. The podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license. For details, see offbeatorgan.com/cc. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band, atlasstringband.com, and it was written by Carmen Ficarra. I do this for learning and for fun, so I don't sell advertising and I don't ask for donations, but if you feel a need to make a donation, may I suggest you buy a copy of my book instead? It's called Wicked Portland, The Wild and Lusty Underworld of a Frontier Seaport Town, published by the History Press in 2012. You can order a signed copy if you like from the store link at offbeatorgan.com, but if you still have a local community bookstore in your town, I hope you'll consider buying it from them instead. It sells for $20. Finally, if you're ever in Corvallis, do drop me a line. Maybe we can grab a cup of coffee and talk history. I'm at finn@offbeatoregon.com. Don't be a stranger. Our next show will be coming your way at around 6 a.m. Monday morning. And until then, go fill up the rest of today and the weekend with good stuff. Bye now.